America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, greetings, my friends. They finally did it. The first Supreme Court serious whack at abortion. And this just came down. This decision, the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003, was the legislation as signed by George W. Bush in the presence of not one single woman. And the law reads, Congress finds and declares the following: my moral, medical, and ethical consensus exists that the practice of performing a partial birth abortion, and then they describe it in rather gruesome terms, is a gruesome and inhumane procedure that is never medically necessary and should be prohibited. This is from the law that was just upheld. Okay. And it goes on to say, there is no credible evidence that partial birth abortions are safe or are safer than other abortion procedures. No controlled studies of partial birth abortions have been conducted. This is in the law. Now, there's a reason for that. And that is that there is no such thing medically as partial birth abortions. As the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists put out in their news release, September 22nd of last year, when they filed the amicus brief in this case, Gonzalez versus Carhart and Gonzalez, and Gonzalez versus PPFA. In the past, the courts had struck down laws that said that this procedure could not be used in second trimester abortions. We're talking between 3 and 6 months into a pregnancy. They say the courts were correct each time they struck down such ill-conceived and unconstitutional restrictions on physicians' ability to provide patients with the safest possible medical care. According to Douglas W. Laub, L-A-U-B-E, M.D., M.Ed., president of ACOG, the act purports to ban so-called partial birth abortions. This is from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. However, partial birth abortion is not a medical term and is not recognized in the field of medicine. The Act defines partial birth abortion in a way that encompasses a variation of dilation and evacuation, D&E, the most common method of second trimester abortion, in which the fetus remains intact as it is removed through the woman's uterus. The Act's definition also encompasses some D&E procedures in which the fetus is not removed intact. Over 95% of abortions in the second trimester are performed using the D&E method. The alternatives to D&E, now this is what women are going to be stuck with, regardless of health, by the way. This law does not provide exceptions for a woman's health. The alternatives to D&E in the second trimester, we're talking about somebody who is 3 months and 1 day pregnant. The alternatives to D&E in the second trimester are abdominal surgery or an induced abortion, induction abortion. Doctors rarely perform an abortion by abdominal surgery because doing so entails far greater risks to the woman. Well, they will be doing it now. The induction method, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists goes on to say, the induction method imposes serious risk to women with certain medical conditions and is entirely contraindicated for other women. So get ready for abdominal surgery because that's the way it's going to go. And this law very specifically says that this is in terms of Chapter 47, partial birth abortions, as used in this section, they go through this list. Any physician who, in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce, knowingly performs a partial birth abortion and thereby kills a human fetus shall be defined under this title or imprisonment not more than shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. So docs are looking at 2 years in jail. But this subsection, okay, but it goes on that the father, if married to the mother at the time she receives a partial birth abortion, and if the mother has not attained the age of 18 at the day of the maternal And if the mother has not attained the age of 18 years at the time of the abortion, the maternal grandparents of the fetus may, in other words, the husband, or if the woman is under 18, the parents or grandparents may, in a civil action, obtain appropriate relief. Such relief shall include money damages for all injuries, psychological and physical, occasioned by the violation of this section, and statutory damages equal to 3 times the cost of the partial birth abortion. Husbands can sue. Why? Well, obviously, because their wives are their property. What's particularly interesting to me about this, and this is, you know, here we go, political correctness to the wind. But sometime back, during the Clinton administration, Ralph Reed, whenever the issue of abortion came up, and really ultimately what we're discussing here is whether abortion should be outlawed altogether or not, because that's the direction we're going. And, you know, I'll just say right up front, my position is that abortion should be extremely rare. I think it's a tragedy. I have known people who have had abortions with a wide variety of responses to it, frankly. And for some people, it can be very traumatic. For others, you know, it's not. But nonetheless, I think that there's a broad societal consensus that abortion should be very rare. And this comes on the heels, by the way. Three or four days ago, a study was released showing that this abstinence-only sex education, so-called sex education that the Bush administration has been promoting for 5 years, giving millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to religious organizations to conduct abstinence-only sex education, actually produces the same pregnancy rates among teenagers, particularly kids under 15, the same levels of sexual activity as does no sex education. Whereas actual sex education reduces pregnancies. But anyhow, Ralph Reed, back in the 80s, during the Clinton administration, would go after, whenever anybody talked about this, he'd say, oh, it's an anti-Christian agenda. Well, you know, that didn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people, because America's 80% Christian, and so Christians playing as if they were, you know, a minority group. Speaking as a Christian myself, we're not a minority group. You know, 80% of Americans are Christian. So they changed the strategy. William Salatin, back in November 2005, writing in Slate, he says, 3 hours after President Bush nominated Judge Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, a conservative, quote, Catholic-based advocacy organization, end quote, fired a warning shot at liberals. Quote, this is from this conservative Catholic organization, a fundamentalist Catholic organization. Quote, given the likelihood of a vigorous debate, we remain steadfast in our insistence upon a fair and dignified process free of any attack on Judge Alito's Catholic faith and personal beliefs. Attacks by left-wing interest groups are particularly worrisome. What were the attacks on Alito's Catholicism? None. Zero. As William Salatin points out, this is the GOP's new victim shtick. Nominate pro-lifers to the court, brag that they're simply upholding abortion laws favored by a majority of voters, when in fact they're not, by the way, and then when liberals complain, accuse them of attacking a religious minority, specifically Catholics. A well-connected conservative lobby, Salatin notes, the Committee for Justice, ran ads depicting a warning on a courthouse door. Catholics need not apply. The ad accused senators of attacking. This is when William Pryor, who was a Catholic, was being confirmed for the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, former Attorney General of Alabama. The ads accused senators of attacking Pryor's deeply held Catholic beliefs. In fact, no senator had ever mentioned the fact that Pryor was a Catholic. What they had talked about was his anti-abortion beliefs. So here is the debate between should we have abortion be legal and rare with birth control and sex education available to increase its rarity and good adoption programs, or should we simply outlaw it? I mean, that's the direction we're going. And is this administration using Catholicism as the shield? Is this the neat little political jujitsu that they've used? that to point out that the five members of the court, this is a 5-4 decision, that to point out that the five members of the court who voted to ban this particular type of abortion and force women to have abdominal surgery for abortions, that those five members are Catholic, to point that out is a sign of bigotry. That's the direction they're going. That's the road they're going to go down. 16 minutes past the hour. Back in 1960, John Kennedy was asked whether his Catholicism would inform, in fact, he gave a talk before the Southern Baptist Convention, as I recall, and was asked whether his Catholicism would inform his lawmaking as president, or his ability to uphold the laws as president of the United States. And John Kennedy was unambiguous in his response.
I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens also to be a Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me.
Justice Clarence Thomas, who has converted to Catholicism with the help of Justice Antonin Scalia, they attend the same church. Together, wrote a 137-word concurring opinion in this case today, in which they said, and I quote, Roe v. Wade has no basis in the Constitution, end quote. This was a 5-4 decision. The five Catholics on the court, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, voting to ban a technique of abortion. This isn't a late-term abortion ban. This is a ban on a technique. And it's called the intact variant of DNE, of dilation and extraction. In other words, a vaginal abortion. And so now the American College of Gynecologists has said, quote, the intact variant of DNE offers significant safety advantages over the non-intact method, including a reduced risk of catastrophic hemorrhage and life-threatening infection. These safety advantages are widely recognized by experts in the field of women's health, authoritative medical texts, peer-reviewed studies, and the nation's leading medical schools. Doesn't matter. Ideology trumps medicine. I really think that it's time that we have, rather than this incrementalism, why don't we just have this discussion right up front as Americans? My own personal opinion is if there is going to be legislation that has to do with abortion, only women should be allowed to vote on it. Period. Because you have half the population that is at some point in their life may or may not be in need of or desirous of this procedure, and another half of the population that, you know, may have an opinion and may be involved, but it's not my body that's ever going to have an abortion. So, number one, I think that only women should be able to vote on this, and then, you know, let's see what the majority, you know, what is the will of the majority, but let's have a discussion. A frank and candid and honest discussion in the United States about whether or not we're going to go back to the way it was back when I was in high school in the mid-1960s. I remember it must have been 67, I think, of my first year in high school, that there was a girl in our class, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. I didn't know her. You know, it was like a couple hundred kids in my class, but I knew who she was. And one day she just didn't come to school. And about a week later, we discovered that she had died from an infection she got. It went septic. It went into her bloodstream. That was the consequence of an illegal abortion she got, because that was the only kind of abortion you could get in 1967 or 68, whichever year it was. I think it was 67. And that's a not uncommon experience that people of, you know, of my age and older can tell you. And apparently we're going back to those days. And if that's if that's what the majority of women in America want, then I would defer to that. But I think that we should have a candid and honest discussion about this rather than cloaking it in, let's talk about the surgical technique. If you describe heart surgery, it's gruesome. If you describe any kind of surgery, it's gruesome. You describe abortion surgery, it's particularly gruesome. And that's going to be the talking points on the right. They're going to be describing this technique and abortion in general in the most gruesome terms possible to make everybody shudder and recoil. That's not the issue. The issue is, are we going to, and this is the clearly the first step in this thing, are we going to ban abortion, period, in the United States? Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a scathing dissent. She said the court's opinion tolerates, indeed applauds, federal intervention to ban nationwide a procedure found necessary and proper in certain cases by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. For the first time since Roe v. Wade, the court blesses a prohibition with no exception protecting a woman's health. She also added a note that she said in her dissent. She suggested that this case should not be considered precedent. I thought that was particularly interesting. Really, it was a way of signaling if the court were, if there were one more vote on the court, you know, that this is just a really close thing. This the 5-4 decision. 27 minutes past. Minutes past the hour. Ruth Bader Ginsburg speaking out strongly against this 5-4 decision. Now, see, this is the amazing thing. If I say the five Catholics on the court voting to ban abortion, two of them saying that they find no constitutional basis for Roe, there will be, I guarantee, and particularly if it were said on, say, the CBS Evening News or something like that. There would be all this, it's anti-Catholic bigotry types of response as an attempt to enforce political correctness, the right's attempt to enforce political correctness, and say, how dare you suggest that this has anything to do with Catholicism? Well, I'm not suggesting that it is specifically that these five members of the court are specifically doing this because they are Catholic or have voted this way. But it is something I think we should notice is that there is that Scalia and Thomas at least have penned this attachment to today's decision saying that they don't even think that Roe v. Wade is constitutional. Throw the whole thing out. Kennedy has gone along with this. Bush apparently now has his 5-4 majority. And the times, they are changing. And as I said, this is something that ultimately has to be up to the American people. What the Supreme Court upheld, by the way, is a federal law. A federal law. This is the so-called partial birth abortion bill. There is no such thing as partial birth abortion. It's not a medical term. It's called dilation and extraction. And about 90 to 95% of all abortions are performed this way. D&Es. And the Supreme Court has upheld a ban on this. And this doesn't, by the way, this is not late-term abortion. People say, oh, it's late-term abortions, or it's not partial birth. It's got nothing to do with birth. There's no birth involved. This is a ban on this particular technique. The intact variant of DNE is how it's referred to as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Then what's next? And is that a road we want to go down on? You know, as I said, my opinion is I think that abortion should be rare, safe, and legal, with the emphasis on rare. Well, actually, the emphasis on all three. But I also say right up front, I don't think I should be entitled to an opinion at vote, because I think only women should be able to vote on this, frankly. Rachel in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment. I was wondering about your opinion. I know you just said they're not partial birth abortions, but I don't know what else to call them. But I'm just wondering what's the difference.
Call it D&E.
I'm sorry?
Call it D&E.
Okay. I understand an abortion when a baby cannot survive outside of the womb. But at the point where the baby can survive outside of the womb, if a woman were to induce her own labor and leave a baby in a trash can, she would be held for child abuse and murder. But if a woman goes and has an abortion when the baby can survive outside of the womb, it's abortion and nothing is wrong with that. And I'm just wondering.
No, that's not true, Rachel. I'm sorry.
I had a baby at 2 months premature, and he survived fine.
Sure, and that's not uncommon. And if you went to a doctor, Rachel, 7 months pregnant, and said, "I want an abortion," you would be turned away. My understanding is that in most cases, and probably in all cases, unless your life was at risk, it would be illegal. Roe v. Wade established to a certain extent that viability was one of the primary criteria. And so your point that, you know, if a fetus can exist outside the womb, then that's a different thing than abortion.
Would a woman be held for child abuse and murder if she does it herself, but would be okay with abortion? You know, what's the difference?
It's not okay with abortion with a viable child. If you go in at 7, 8, 9 months, if you have a viable fetus and your life is not in danger, you cannot get an abortion.
Okay.
It's illegal. It's not an option.
So
somebody's been lying to you.
What you're talking about then.
That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about are abortions. This could be in the second month.
Okay.
This could be in the third month. I'm talking about and what the Supreme Court decision is talking about. What they're saying is that if the abortion is done through the vaginally, if it's done the normal way that an abortion is done, that it's now illegal. If it's at the end, so the alternative is to cut open your stomach and do the abortion.
Okay.
And or give you enough drugs that it induces an abortion, both of which dramatically increase the risk that the woman will die.
Okay.
That's what this law has done. Thank you, Rachel, for the call. Bob in Corvallis, Oregon. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. Last night when I was watching the wall-to-wall media frenzy about Virginia, it was, you know, all over the news. I was wondering, what were they going to try to sneak through? I was actually suspecting that the Bush administration would launch an attack on Iran. They may still yet do it.
No, instead they launched an attack on women.
But, well, yeah, I mean, I knew something would be coming. I just, because that's the way they operate, like these old spiders waiting for the right time to strike. Effectively, this seems to me that it is a de facto ban on abortion right now, because it places the onus on the doctor, does it not, to decide when the first trimester is over. And to do that's really a subjective call, because you'd have to know the moment of conception to know whether it's a minute after the beginning of the second trimester or a minute before the second trimester.
Well, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not an expert on abortion, and I'm not presenting myself as either one. That said, I have read this law this morning. I spent the better part of 40 minutes going through and reading this law, and maybe I missed it, but I didn't see any place in it where it said it had to be in the second trimester.
Oh, I misunderstood. I think this
could effectively ban any abortion.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, in other words, the doctor's going to say, this woman is pregnant. I don't know when she was conceived. It could be 3 weeks ago. It could be 4 or 5. I don't know precisely when the conception occurred. And am I going to have to prove my innocence in court? Am I going to have to face a jail situation?
That's right.
And so what the doctors and the hospitals are going to say, look, we can't afford this. We're just not going to do this procedure anymore.
Yeah, and that's what I predict is going to be happening.
Well,
plus the law bizarrely says that husbands can sue their wives for psychological distress.
So that's it.
For any monetary amount that they want in a civil court, and that grandparents and parents can sue if the woman is under 18 years old, can sue the woman. The woman can be sued.
Now,
and I mean, this is crazy.
Well, it is. And also
Tom? Go ahead. Yeah.
Hello. What happens if a woman, now, is there, you said there's no provision for her health. Supposing she's sick or is in a car accident and decides that this is the procedure that needs to be done because she's already lost too much blood or something.
Right.
Is she going to be forced to die? Is that what this is going to do?
Yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding of it. If I'm reading this right but from time to time, I get things wrong, and I will correct myself on the air, but that's my reading of it right now. And that's certainly what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, who sat there through all the arguments and all the hearings. She said, for the first time, so this is a verbatim quote from her dissent, that is part of now the law of the United States and the statute. She said, for the first time since Roe, the court blesses a prohibition with no exception protecting a woman's health. So, yeah, bottom line. Now, the point I was making earlier, this is a federal law that the Supreme Court ruled on, which means it can become a federal unlaw. That is to say that the House of Representatives and the Senate can put forward a law, or it can revoke the law, basically. They can pass another piece of legislation saying, you know, that piece of legislation that we call the partial birth abortion ban, we're undoing that. And that say this law is constitutional after a whole bunch of lower courts had struck it down saying it was unconstitutional. Roberto at San Diego, California. Hey, Roberto. No, Roberto. Amy in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's up?
Well, I'm outraged by what's taking place here. About 2.5 months ago, I had a DNE. I had 100% fatal birth defect. And the doctors recommended going ahead and having a D&E. I had a C-section with my first child, and if I carried this to term, I mean, not only would it put strain on my family, you know, marriage, it was, it would
be
a strain on the
body.
But the
child would have died. He had a fatal birth defect.
Yes, it had no skull, basically.
Right.
So, those, babies.
This procedure is no longer available to you, Amy. No.
Yeah.
Or I mean, to any woman in your circumstances.
I couldn't imagine having to carry this baby to term, you know. I mean, it would just...
knowing that it would be dead and you might be dead as well.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to... I mean, I would then still be struggling with it right now.
Yeah.
You know, my healing process was able to start sooner because that child was not going to live.
Right.
Are you
Catholic,
as soon as it came out.
And you said you were Catholic to our call?
Yes, I'm Catholic as well.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. I
appreciate
it. Okay. 45 minutes past the hour.
In the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I tucked my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, you look like a fine, outstanding young man. Oh, yeah, I think you'll do. So I pulled off my hat and said, I'm not tonight. Hey, for me working for you.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. What happened to the old days?
I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens also to be a Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me.
Is it Catholic bashing to raise the issue that the five Catholics on the court all voted to ban abortions, ban this one particular technique for abortion, regardless of when it's practiced? Or is it simply stating the obvious? Or is it got nothing to do with that? I think that you could probably argue any of those positions. I'm not saying it as Catholic bashing, but I am, and speaking as a Protestant, I am concerned that religion is infiltrating law. That we had defined human life as at the point of viability prior to this point in time, and now we are defining it, we're moving back toward defining it at conception. And what's going to be next? Rolling back the, as I recall, it's the Cunningham decision in Connecticut that said it's illegal for a married couple to have condoms in their house. The police can come in, kick down your door, drag you off to jail if you have condoms in your home, if you're a married couple. This was the law in Connecticut as recently as 1960-something. As I recall, it was 64. So, what's it going to be? Keith in Stratford, Connecticut. Hey, Steve. Hey, Keith, speaking of Connecticut. Hey, Keith.
Hey, how are you?
Great. What's up?
My wife had... back in 1977, in the fifth month of her pregnancy, it was a bad implantation, and the doctor, she was almost going to die. The doctor said, we have to abort the pregnancy. The problem was that he took it upon himself, I guess. I really don't know why, but they induced labor instead of doing a D&E, and the child was born alive with severe birth defects. He mercifully died in a day. Yeah. So I have a son in St. Michael's Cemetery who lived one day, but that child would have been severely handicapped.
Yeah.
This whole idea of forcing doctors to use an inducement for an abortion is a very, very bad idea.
Yeah. Keith, thanks for sharing your experience with us. It's it puts a human face on it. It really does. Chris in Inverness, California. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just woke up a few minutes ago, and I didn't know anything about this. Set me to recollecting. In the early 60s, pre-R.V. Wade, my girlfriend, to be my wife, my first wife, we were students at a prominent Southern California university. She was still living at home. I had my rooms and so on. She got pregnant. And I don't have a lurid story to tell you, but there's a lesson to be learned from this. Fortunately, see, we were in Southern California. Her parents were well-connected, knew a lot of people, let's just say. And we were able to set up an appointment in a very modern, lovely clinic in Tijuana. Mm-hmm. And but I will never forget that day.
Yeah.
Mom and the girlfriend went into the clinic, and I was left with the stepfather and me. And we walked around Tijuana for about 3 hours. I'm laughing, but it was the most...
it's a very difficult thing.
Yeah,
it's going to be a very difficult thing.
Okay,
go ahead.
The point being to this is how lucky we were.
Mm-hmm.
How 1 percentile we were. Mm-hmm. And I've had since, it's been a long life, hey, I've had a couple of other experiences post Roe v. Wade, and while certainly painful, it was, a 10-minute drive, and blah, 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 and so on, and so on. By the way, and just finally, you say only women should be allowed to vote on this? You know, who's the 2,000-pound elephant in the living room here? It's the doctors. Where are the doctors? I mean,
the doctors are the ones who are being prosecuted.
Well, I understand that, and perhaps now, if that being so, some doctors will start to speak it up. You know,
yeah, well, they've been speaking out all along. But, you know, good point and well made. Thank you, Chris. Julie in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Julie.
Hi. Say, I have a couple of experiences that I think are very relevant for those who would like to make choices for others.
We just have about 50 seconds, Julie.
Pardon?
We have about 50 seconds before we have to wrap up this hour.
Okay. Just very quickly, 22 years ago, I was asked to have an abortion by my child's biological father. I refused, and I have a lovely 22-year-old daughter. 7 years later, my water broke prematurely, and a perinatologist told me I had to have an abortion because my child would be born severely deformed. I chose not to, and I have a lovely 16-year-old son. Bottom line is nobody has the right to choose for other people. I personally chose not to have an abortion in either one of those cases because that's my belief structure. I do not have the right to impose that on anybody else for any reason, and I think that's the bottom line.
That's very, very well said, Julie, and I honor your choices, and frankly, we should all honor the choice of any woman to go in either direction as long as we're talking about a non-viable fetus, in my opinion. Julie,
exactly.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us. 57 minutes past the hour. We're also going to be talking about, I want to get into George W. Bush's culture of death and bring this back to Virginia Tech and also what happened in Russia. What's the KGB up to right after this?
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Welcome back. The extraordinary decision by the Supreme Court today, of course, at the top of the news, but there's an awful lot of other things going on. For example, as America is mourning the death of 32 and the suicide killer, 33 people altogether in Blacksburg, Virginia at VTech. Iraq is mourning 127 people killed by four large bombs that went off yesterday in Baghdad alone. In the deadliest of the attacks, a parked car detonated in a crowd of workers at the Sharia market in the mostly Shiite area of central Baghdad, killing at least 82 people and wounding 94. That was the first of four bombings that happened yesterday in Baghdad, killing at least 127 people. I would submit to you that this is the Bush administration culture of death at work, that we have been, as Zbigniew Brzezinski pointed out in the Washington Post on March 25th, we have been terrorized by the war on terror. Now, Brzezinski suggested that this is actually a methodical and intentional thing, that focusing on the most gruesome aspects of anything, whether it's abortion, oh, it's partial birth abortion. No, I'm sorry. There's no such thing as partial birth abortion. This is a medical technique called the intact variant of DNA. Or whether it's the so-called war on terror, or whether it's the shooting in Virginia. George W. Bush figures out a way to make it gruesome and horrific and to use it to generate fear. You would think that in a speech before a group of grieving students and parents and faculty, people who have had friends and neighbors killed, that the representative of all of the rest of us, the President of the United States, would offer words of compassion. Carl Wolfson, my co-host on the morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, the radio program that I do before this show, made the comment this morning that at Ronald Reagan's funeral, Jerry Ford told a joke. He made people smile. Reagan would have loved it. My father died last summer. And at his funeral, the pastor of the church that my parents were members of, the United Methodist Church in Lansing, Michigan, gave a marvelous eulogy in which he talked about all the wonderful things about my father and his life. It made us all, I mean, you know, I've cried halfway through the thing, cried through half of it, but it reminded us of wonder and brought back all kinds of positive memories. The last thing you want to do with people who are on the edge emotionally is revisit grief. I mean, if that pastor at my father's funeral had stood up and talked about how my father died, because he died of mesothelioma, of this god-awful lung cancer that he got by being exposed to asbestos working in a steel mill. One of two jobs he was working, because my mother had gotten pregnant with me in 1951. And it eventually, that and working in a tool and die shop for 40 years where the steel used to come in rolls of asbestos. I remember being a little kid playing with the stuff, corrugated asbestos. And it was a very, very painful death. And Louise and I sat there with him, and I'm not going to go through the gruesome details with you either right now, because I don't want to terrorize you, you know, or totally gross you out. But the fact of the matter is, if the pastor had stood up and started talking about how my father died, it would have been a horrific, it would have been an unimaginably awful experience for all of us. So George W. Bush, the representative of all of us, goes to the University of Virginia, and while this is not a eulogy, obviously, but it's something in that family. I mean, it's talking to the bereaved, it's talking to the people who are in anguish. And what does he do? He reinvokes those horrible feelings, that horrible experience. Bush at Virginia Tech.
Yesterday began like any other day. Students woke up and they grabbed their backpacks and they headed for class. And soon the day took a dark turn, with students and faculty barricading themselves in classrooms and dormitories, confused, terrified, and deeply worried. By the end of the morning, it was the worst day of violence on a college campus in American history. And for many of you here today, it was the worst day of your lives.
And as a consequence of this, after he finished speaking, they had a moment of silence, and this is what this is what happened.
Brief interruption in the convocation here. You can see that someone collapsed on the floor, had to be helped to their feet.
Medics are helping to remove a few family members of that person as well. Clearly emotions are running high, and bet you there's a heck of a lot of people there that didn't get much sleep.
Yeah, and let's even terrorize people who have just been terrorized. As Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote, the war on terror has created a culture of fear in America. The Bush administration's elevation of these three words, war on terror, into a national mantra since the horrific events of 9/11 has had a pernicious effect on American democracy, on America's psyche, and on U.S. standing in the world. Now, my take on why Bush is so fond of his war on terror and we got to kill them over there before they try to, you know, it's just his obsession with death, is that there is, frankly, just something fundamentally wrong, something fundamentally flawed in his personality that causes him to embrace death. From his childhood experience of sticking firecrackers in frogs and watching them explode and thinking that was fun, to his joking about Carla Faye Tucker, his execution of her, where he sat with Tucker Carlson, an odd juxtaposition of names, but and made a joke. She said, "Save me, Governor Bush, save me, please." Ha 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 ha. Wrung his hands together and made a joke and imitated her voice and then laughed about it. And then he signed her death warrant and sent her off to her death. A woman who had undergone a prison conversion and really, if there was a candidate for rehabilitation, Not to be released into the general population, but just to say, hey, this is a person that you know, we should respect the fact that she regrets what she did. Carla Faye Tucker was right at the top of that list, and off she went. Executing mentally retarded people, executing children, executed a woman, executing people. You know, we know now that one of nine people on death row in states all across the United States has been found to be innocent. Bush, you know, gleefully executing people. As Brzezinski says, the damage these three words have done, war on terror, a classic self-inflicted wound, is infinitely greater than any wild dreams entertained by the fanatical perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks when they were plotting against us in distant Afghan caves. He says, the little secret here may be that the vagueness of the phrase was deliberately or instinctively calculated by its sponsors. It stimulated the emergence of a culture of fear. Fear obscures reason, intensifies emotions, and makes it easier for demagogic politicians to mobilize the public on behalf of the policies they want to pursue. It acquires a life of its own and can become demoralizing. And then he says, America is not the America it was when Franklin Roosevelt said,
let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And you notice Roosevelt brings it back around to advance and says, no, you know, we need to move forward. We need to look forward. Now, Bush is always about the terrible things, the terrible days, those awful circumstances.
Those whose lives were taken did nothing to deserve their fate. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now they're gone, and they leave behind grieving families and grieving classmates and a grieving nation.
And that's it. 16 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Let's take a quick look here at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of April 18, 10:25 Greenwich Mean Time, from Reuters. First of all, four large bombs exploded across Baghdad, killing at least 127 people and wounding scores. Also, Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb killed 10 people and wounded 15 in the predominantly Shiite district of Qarada in the central Baghdad. Also in Baghdad, a bomb inside a minibus killed two people and wounded five near Al-Shirja in central Baghdad. A suicide car bomb targeting a police patrol killed two policemen and wounded four, including two civilians near Baghdad. In Taji, one insurgent was killed and eight others detained during two raids in that city by U.S. military. In Baghdad, U.S. soldiers discovered a cache of nitric acid during a raid on a warehouse in eastern Baghdad. The nitric acid could be used to manufacture explosives. It was stored in 600 5-gallon containers. Three people were detained. In Baghdad, the bodies of 25 people were found shot in various different districts of Baghdad overnight. U.S. forces killed five insurgents, wounded four, and detained 26 during an operation near Garma, about 50 kilometers west of Baghdad. In Baghdad, Iraqi soldiers killed 6 insurgents and arrested 126 in the last 24 hours. In Tal Afar, gunmen attack Iraqi army and police checkpoints in 2 different districts. In Kirkuk, gunmen wounded a judge, his wife, and son in a drive-by shooting. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Ismail Kadhim, a police major who was also a security guard for the Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament. In Baghdad, 4 people were wounded by a mortar round, which landed in the residential district of Dora. And in Baghdad, 4 policemen were wounded in a roadside bomb attack on their patrol. All of this yesterday. Well, up to and including today's 4 big explosions this morning. The ongoing Bush culture of death. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Billy in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Billy.
Yes, hi, Tom. I've got 2 very short questions to ask you, and I can hang up and listen to your answers. But first, I'd like to say that in my personal opinion, and this may qualify me for Guantanamo, George Bush, by all of observation, is a sadistic serial killer. And my 2 questions are, is there an impeachment, a way to impeach anyone on the Supreme Court? And the second question is there in, what are the ages? Is there anyone getting close to, an age where they want to retire or where, God forbid, they'll die?
Yeah, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the liberals on the... First of all, in answer to your question about impeachment, yes, any federal officer can be impeached. Anybody, any federal officer who is confirmed by the Senate can be impeached. However, they have to be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. You can't impeach a member of the United States Supreme Court for a decision that you don't like. So, ain't going to happen. You could argue that the Bush v. Gore decision might be a high crime or misdemeanor, but I think it's a little late now for that. Impeachment is out. With regard to age, you've got at least one of the justices is well into his 80s, 86, as I recall. And Justice Ginsburg has had cancer. So there's most of the older ones are the so-called liberals on the court. The so-called conservatives on the court, you've got, Roberts in his 50s, Scalia in his 50s or his early 60s, Thomas in his mid-50s. I mean, these guys are going to be around for a long, long time. Linda in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Linda, we only have about a half a minute before we've got to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. Quick one.
It was Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965.
Thank you.
1972 was Eisenstadt versus Baird, which challenged the Massachusetts chastity law. So it allowed single people to use birth control. And both of those were important for Roe v. Wade in 73.
Right. So in 65, prior to 65 in Connecticut, a married couple could go to jail for having a condom in their bedroom.
Theoretically. Or diaphragms or anything like that. No birth control could be used.
Right.
By anyone.
And after that, an unmarried couple could still go to jail.
Exactly. Massachusetts chastity law was challenged by Bill Baird. He was a kick-ass activist.
Yeah.
So
amazing. Yeah. Linda, thank you very much for the history lesson. I appreciate it. I got to tell you, on this program, we have the smartest listeners on earth, and I'm really grateful for it. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll continue with your calls and more of the news of the day in just a moment. Listen carefully for your opportunity to support your local station by supporting your sponsors.
Misled into another senseless war, how many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrow's where it ends.
It's listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for our sponsors and letting them know that you're listening and recommending their products to your friends and neighbors and or buying them yourself, including our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS, M-A-C-S, and the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington Crew. Their executive director, Melanie Sloan, and their chief counsel, Ann Weissman, are suggesting in an interview with Jason Leopold and Matt Renner over at Truthout, and a tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room for passing this along to me, by the way, and if you want to hang out with some of the finest minds in the entire Internet, get over to our chat room and go to tomhartman.com and click live chat, and hopefully one of these days soon we'll have a link off airamerica.com as well for our live chat room. The chief counsel and the executive director of Crew have done a little investigative, well, not report, some serious digging here into what Harriet Myers told Patrick Fitzgerald back when Fitzgerald was investigating the outing of Valerie Plame. You will recall that, you know, the event, the bringing down of an entire CIA operation, the outing of a CIA agent, the destruction of an international counterterrorism, anti-terrorism operation by the Bush administration. And Patrick Fitzgerald was given the task of finding out who did this leak and, you know, did it break a law? And if so, let's put that person, let's throw their butt in jail. And one of the things that he asked for were copies of White House emails, internal correspondence that may have to do with this. And he was apparently briefed, well, not apparently, he was briefed by Harriet Myers and was told, you know, here's everything we've got. The White House, in fact, a little, you know, the story first reported by Truthout last year, Fitzgerald revealed his investigative team learned that not all email of the Office of the Vice President and Executive Office of the President for certain time periods in 2003 was preserved through the normal archiving process of the White House computer system. Less than 2 weeks after Fitzgerald revealed that emails from the White House were missing, 250 pages of emails from Bush and Cheney's office were turned over to investigators more than 2 years after the investigation had begun. It was like, oops! You know, keep in mind, this is our president who is, you know, all about, well, you know, we don't know what we're going to find. We don't know where it is. It's, we're not, well, it's...
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official, now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
He's got no idea whatsoever. And so, anyhow, Fitzgerald was given this job. Well, apparently, Myers lied to him. I mean, that's what this investigation suggests. As I say, this is a long and detailed analysis of it, and you can read it over at truthout.org. But it sure is looking like the White House has been hiding this thing for a long, long time. And now it is starting to come out. And a fine thing it is. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Karen in Los Angeles. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Let's go back to the violation and extraction discussion.
Sure. For our listeners who may have just tuned in, if I may, just very quickly,
sorry.
The Supreme Court just upheld the 2003 federal so-called partial birth abortion law. There's no such thing as partial birth abortion. The medical term is dilation extraction, or D&E. And in doing so, Scalia and Thomas even went so far as to say that they can find no constitutional basis for Roe v. Wade. Your
right.
turn, Karen.
Well, the thing that kind of irks me the most about this is the anti-choicers are using a legitimate medical procedure only to afford their cause, but tying the hands of doctors. They make the procedure sound like it's nothing, that any woman can walk into a clinic anywhere in America at 7, 8, 9 months and go, get rid of it, I'm done, I don't want it, and then she skips off and goes and gets a manicure. You know, it doesn't work that way. It's a very
right.
serious procedure. It needs hospitalization at least overnight, possibly longer than that. You know, it is a serious surgical procedure. It is not taken lightly, and doctors in America don't go, okay, you're done being pregnant. Okay, hon, here, let me help you. It doesn't
right.
work that way. And
yep.
that, and I think these kind of laws, they make light of these serious issues.
Yeah, and I think many of us in 2003, when this law was first passed, many of us saw it as political grandstanding that didn't have a chance. And, in fact, that was before Roberts and Alito were appointed to the Supreme Court. And at that time, it was political grandstanding, and it didn't have a chance, because Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor would have said no to this.
Right.
But now we've got Scalia and, or excuse me, we have Alito and Scalito. We have Alito and Roberts.
They're interchangeable.
yeah, really. I mean, the whole bunch of them.
Yes.
And now the what was the unthinkable has become the thinkable, and frankly, this is an assault on a woman's right to have an abortion, period, right across the board.
It was like your previous caller's like, well, if she can go in and have an abortion, right, but she can't abandon the baby. It's like, that's the point, is people do not understand the procedure. People do not understand that it's not used regularly. It's very, very rare. But when it is used, it's used because the woman's life is in jeopardy.
Or because the fetus is so deformed that there's no possibility of it surviving outside the womb.
Well, even
so why
then,
stress the woman by pushing her through the whole pregnancy?
Well, actually, it depends on where you're at in your pregnancy. Like, if you're close to, because I had a stillbirth, but I had to induce. They obviously aren't going to do DNA on me because I was 20 or 30 weeks pregnant. So, you know, I just went through labor.
Right.
Because obviously there was no health risk for me going into labor.
Yeah.
You know, and so it depends on where you're at, what the condition of the fetus is. I mean, in the case of hydrocephalus, DNA is required unless
right.
you can do C-section. A C-section ups your chances for blood clots. Serious health problems, you know, I've had two, I should know, you know.
Hemorrhaging. And now women are going to be forced to have a C-section-like procedure in order to have an abortion in these kind of cases. And this is putting women at risk. And then they can be sued by their husbands for monetary damages or their parents because, of course, they're the property of their husbands or their parents.
Well, and then the other thing that bugs me is, well, why can't she have a C-section? You have major abdominal surgery and see how well you do. This, you know, people, that's
right.
Another one is, you know, C-section, big deal. Excuse me, major abdominal surgery. Had it twice, should know. You know, this is not simple black and white. Oh, what's wrong with her? You know, that's not the issue.
This is stuff that should be left between women, their doctors, and if there's a religious issue for them, their priest or rabbi or whatever, and the rest of us as a society should back off and get out of these women's lives, in my opinion, and apparently in yours as well, Karen. Karen, I got to move along, but I thank you for your very well-spoken comments. Well said. Mickey in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mickey.
Good morning, Mr. Hartman. A couple comments. Please Google The Red Mass and look up the lawyers and judges and government officials.
The Red Mass. Mass is a Catholic Mass, M-A-S-S?
M-A-S-S. And
okay.
It's a 13th century cultish procedure that the Roman Catholic Church involves folks like Justice Scalia in 2001 and in Justice Thomas in 1999. I'm really concerned about the makeup of the judiciary that is paying allegiance to a group called the St. Thomas More Society that suggests that they can be the king's servants, but their allegiance is to God first. So
yeah, it's not that five members of the Supreme Court are Catholics. It's that
five?
Apparently four. Yes, five members of the Supreme Court
God.
Are Catholic now: Thomas, Roberts, Alito, Kennedy, and Scalia.
God.
And it's not that five of them are Catholic. It's that four of those five are fundamentalist Catholics. They're members of fundamentalist organizations and religions and hold fundamentalist views. And frankly, I would be as concerned about five fundamentalist Protestants or five fundamentalist Jews. I mean, you know, pick your religion.
The
fundamentalism.
A big distinction, Tom, pardon me for interrupting. The Protestant Church is not a foreign government. The Holy Roman Catholic Church is. And
well,
in
that's,
fact,
that's a good point.
In fact, taxes are paid to that government, the Peter Pence tax, while these churches are getting a free ride with taxes here in this state.
And
anyway,
the government is also a member of the United Nations body on birth control, and it's the only member of that. I forget the name of the group in the UN that oversees birth control worldwide. You know, the UN's role in it.
Well, the
Vatican is a member.
The children.
Right, the Vatican is a member of that, and the Vatican has no women who are citizens.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Nikki. I remember when I visited the Vatican, when I was invited to go meet Pope John Paul II and have what was referred to as a private audience with him. It was more of a photo opportunity and a you know 15 or 20 second, less than a minute conversation, very brief, but it was interesting. 45 minutes past the hour. Certainly looking that way, and perhaps oil and war and the control of others. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com, their website. Victoria, Julian, who's running the board right now and the guy who has his hand on your volume control, says he's watching C-SPAN and he loves your new haircut.
Oh, that's all that matters, Tom. None of the rest of it matters.
This is the breaking news. Victoria Jones is on C-SPAN right now and has a new haircut.
It's all that I care about.
Julian is all of Twitter.
It's the only
thing. As are we all.
It's the only thing. It would be the only thing, except that it's a day where we have an embarrassment of riches, where we have the Supreme Court chipping away at Roe versus Wade, where we've got congressional leaders coming to meet with the president in just a couple of seconds, and where we've got my rather brilliant question for the president at the briefing.
Now, let's start with your brilliant question for the president. George W. Bush actually pointed to you and said yes?
No, he didn't. This is the briefing. Dana Perino pointed to me and said, Victoria.
I see.
As he usually does. Well, on Monday, in his speech, President Bush said, families gathered here understand that our troops want to finish the job. And on some of the left-wing blogs, they started to question whether this is in fact the case, whether there was in fact any evidence that the troops want to finish the job. And they came to the conclusion that there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the troops want to finish the job. So I thought I'd question this, and I did. And I asked her, what was the empirical evidence that the troops want to finish the job in Iraq? And, of course, there isn't any.
No, of course. The 70-some-odd percent of the troops want to come home within 6 months.
And,
period.
So I was treated to a sort of list of that he's spoken to families and he's spoken to troops and he's spoken to generals and he's spoken to families and he's spoken to troops and he's spoken to generals. And she repeated that two or three times. And
poor Dana. I know you would never say this because you're well spoken and you also have to work with these folks. But I get the impression and no need to even comment on this. But I just get the impression that, you know, Tony Snow is a scrapper and Scott McClellan knew what he was doing. But Dana Perino seems like she's out of her league. She's just in over her head. And I almost, you know, feel sorry for her on some days. But In any case, so she had no evidence that Bush actually had.
There was no evidence at all.
Yeah. Okay. And then the Supreme Court. Now I've been, you know, as you can imagine, the last hour and 40 minutes here, we've been talking about the Supreme Court decision at some length, along with other things like, you know, this massive bombing in Iraq and Bush's remarks at the University of Virginia Tech. Which just threw everybody back into, you know, panic and crisis and awful feelings, a whole variety of things. But give us the reporter take on the Supreme Court decision.
Well, this
seems, you said it's chipping away. It seems to me like it's a cannon shot.
Yes, I think that some people would say it's more of a cannon shot than chipping away. And if any one of the four Supreme Court justices who went against this decision were to keel over tomorrow, and one of them, I believe, is 87 years old, then it's
yes,
all
Mr.
over
Stevens.
For Ruth versus Wade.
Yeah, Mr. Stevens is 86 or 87, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had cancer and is in her 70s. And so, yeah.
So there's no question. And also my understanding is that Kennedy's ruling pretty much asks the states to really seriously take a look at what it is that they can do in terms of further chipping away at Roe versus Wade and looking at ways to cut back on the different ways that abortion can be performed
right.
and on the dates by which this procedure can be performed. So,
and Scalia and Thomas appended a concurring opinion to this thing, 137 words as I recall, that said that they can find no basis in the Constitution for Roe v. Wade. In other words, Roe v. Wade is unconstitutional in their opinion.
Which doesn't surprise me at all. I mean,
yeah, but it's.
So we see where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
And now Ben Aprino was asked a question about this in terms of, you know, whether this showed that the court was leaning to the right. And her reply was, well, would those same people say that about the court considering what their ruling was on the environment last week?
What does that have to do with?
In other words, the ruling on the environment, which was pro-environment, could be seen as a left-leaning court.
I see. So the right doesn't care about the environment? Was that her point?
I think that was her point.
Well, that's an interesting admission. You know, Barry Goldwater, Everett Dirksen, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon started the Environmental Protection Agency. I thought that there was a fairly reasonable consensus among conservatives and progressives and liberals, you know, right across America that we would like our water to be drinkable and our air to be clean and our parks to be, you know, viable and all that kind of thing.
If she got a pass on that from the press corps.
Yeah, apparently it's a left-wing conspiracy to have a clean world.
That's right. That's right. The right don't want it clean.
Duh. So anything else in going on in Washington that we should know about?
Yes, the big congressional meeting with the president this afternoon that happened at 2:30. That's
mm-hmm.
the big thing, where the president is expecting that they will have got their story straight and they'll have sorted themselves out and decided all themselves exactly what it is that they want, and that they'll all come together, get on their knees, and come before him.
This is with regard to the Iraq appropriation?
This is for the Iraq appropriations. This is for the supplemental. This is for a meeting of the minds where everybody gets together and they all come together and sing Kumbaya. The difficulty is that there will be no Kumbaya sung because the Democrats certainly don't intend to sing it. They have their own agenda. The president has his own agenda. Why the Republican leaders are there, I don't really know, because they're sort of on the sidelines. They've got actually nothing to say.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Bush just is digging himself deeper and deeper into this thing, in my opinion. But, you know, time will tell. We'll see how it shakes out. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. Coming up in the next hour, Yuri Felshtinsky is going to be talking about why that Russian spy got poisoned. And Larry Scott from VA Watchdog will be with us.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you need to know, and sometimes you don't know that you don't know that what you don't know or you need to know, or sometimes, as the folks at the Fireside Theater so aptly say,
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, by the way, sponsored by theliberalstore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there. That's the, with a T-H-E, theliberalstore.com. This, our Everything You Know Is Wrong story, brought to me by Todd Tulsis here at Clear Channel in in Portland. He's our production guy and a brilliant one at that. And must be very well paid, Todd, because he has all these stock annual meeting shareholder things here that he keeps sharing with me. This one from the Altria Group. The Altria, A-L-T, I don't know if Todd owns the stock or not. Sorry, Todd, if I'm outing you here. But anyhow, this is amazing. Altria used to be Philip Morris, and they changed their name. And if you own stock in Altria, you now have an opportunity today, or over the course of the next week or so, you have an opportunity to vote on Proposal 4 to get Altria, formerly known as Philip Morris, out of the tobacco business by 2010. Believe it or not, that's on the ballot right now for this company. It says this is put on by a Dominican group who owns 75 shares of stock. Now, if you only own 75 shares of stock, it's awful hard to get anything on the ballot for the annual meeting of a major multinational corporation like Altria. They must have had a lot of support from major investors within this company. And here's what it says. Whereas in 1973, a Philip Morris representative stated, quote, "We all know that once a consumer product has been proven by the medical profession to be harmful to the human body, the product will be banned from sales, and whatever has been sold will be withdrawn from the trade," end quote. He said, "If cigarettes would be undeniably proven to be harmful and conducive to lung cancer, there will definitely be a ban on cigarette sales worldwide," end quote. This is what a Philip Morris spokesman said in 1973. Later in the film Death in the West, a Philip Morris vice president declared that if it were shown cigarettes could cause harm, quote, "We would withdraw them," end quote. Philip Morris USA has never disavowed these statements, resolved that since it acknowledges the science showing its tobacco products cause disease and death, shareholders request the board of directors initiate steps to sell or phase out all production, promotion, and marketing of its health hazardous and addictive tobacco products by 2010. Amazing. Now, in addition to that, Proposal 5 is one for the ethical treatment of animals, refining and replacing its use of animals in research. That's a good one. Proposal 3, stop all company-sponsored campaigns allegedly oriented to preventing youth from smoking. Why? Because they don't work. This citing a study in the December 2006 American Journal of Public Health. This was put forward by the Sisters of Mercy of the Americas. You know, two of these activist stockholder groups, Catholic groups. Good on them. Congratulations. Proposal number 2. This is from the St. Joseph Capuchin Order. I believe that that's a Catholic order in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They put forward, this is proposal number 2 for Altria, informing children of their rights if forced to incur secondhand smoke, that they should be read their rights. You have the right not to breathe this air. I think this is great. This is great. So the stockholders of Altria Group, Inc., in the notice of their annual meeting of stockholders, Thursday, April 26, 2007, and proxy statement, have an opportunity to vote on this thing if you get your vote in before April 26th. So have fun and consider it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tina in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Tina, welcome to the program.
Hi. You caught me by surprise. I didn't think I was going to get on, but I am interested in just bringing up the subject of Africa and how, when you've been talking just recently about doing how the weapons of mass deception and how the Bush administration's policies basically, well, there's this expression from down south, which is, "Don't urinate down my back and tell me it's raining."
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Basically, you can just say that that's their policy across the board. And I'm really concerned about what is going on right now with them in Africa. And I wanted to bring that up because there's a lot of different things
Bush has mentioned
Well, Bush,
them.
You know, Bush said some nice words today about Darfur. He said he told the president of Sudan that he better, you know, they're allowing a few UN forces in there, that they should do more. But I mean, I think the big turning point was when the world saw the Google Earth pictures. I think it was, you know, the satellite pictures where you could see these sites of massacres. But it's not just Darfur. There are problems happening in a number of places on that continent. In Zimbabwe, just a horrific mess under Mr. Mugabe, and Uganda's having some troubles right now. It's a continent that needs the attention of the world. Well said, Tina, and thank you for pointing it out. It really does. Eileen in Somerville, South Carolina. Hey, Eileen, welcome to the program. Eileen? Nope, Eileen is not there. We'll go to Rochelle in Carson, Washington. Hey, Rochelle.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, is this Tom?
Yeah, it is, and you're on the air, Eileen.
Yes, thank you.
Or Rochelle, excuse me.
Pardon me? Rochelle, yes.
Yes.
I wanted to make sure and bring, it is important to me to make this point clear. Mm-hmm. From Bush's, from this, inside of the accomplishments of this administration, to the betterment of the country, I think there have been none. And it is imperative to understand that Bush's agenda is politically driven. And when it comes to this abortion law that they just passed, I think it is for a political, it is politically motivated, and
well,
it is to... I don't know, he's using the religious part to kind of like, you know, a self-righteousness and shaming the people to say that abortion is such a, you know, it is a taboo still. And I think it is important for us to understand why he's using this card.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of the reasons why his poll numbers probably won't drop below that 30%, that a large portion of that are people who are religiously motivated and have absolute blind faith in Bush. The abortion part may be a dimension of it or a piece of it. And that's probably one of the reasons why Cheney's approval ratings are only at 19%, because Cheney has a gay daughter and he's in favor of gay marriage. And he's not, you know, he doesn't, even though Bush and Cheney are both members of the Methodist Church, which has decried, by the way, the invasion of Iraq and the ongoing occupation of Iraq, and neither of them attend church, nonetheless, Cheney is not perceived as being the messianic religious figure that Bush is. And I think that that religious right fragment of the population that the Republican Party decided to aggressively go after in the 1980s, or arguably you could flip it around and say that Jerry Falwell and his friends, who were members of that religious right, and Pat Robertson and Mr. Dobson from Focus on the Family, that these guys decided to take over the Republican Party, that they were successful in their takeover of a segment of the Republican Party. I think they got the entire party there for a while. And good point. John in Portland, Oregon. Hey, John, got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Want to comment on the shootings for a moment. I really shudder to think what would happen if this shooter was identified as a Muslim extremist. Our civil rights would be completely eviscerated overnight, and yet nothing will happen politically in this country regarding gun control because the person doesn't fit into that category. But it shows you how disingenuous the threat of terrorism is in the United States, because at any moment, it's so easy to get a gun. And why people can't see through this is absolutely beyond me. And I'd like to say that Bush's comments the other day about those kids being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, where should they have been? They were students at school. Should they not have been on Earth?
Yeah, it's a tough one, John. Thank you for the call. And it's a good point. Had it been a Muslim. Todd sends me a note. Altria is Philip Morris, Miller Brands, Nabisco, and until the other day, Kraft Foods. They spun that off. And he says, oh, by the way, thanks. Now the world knows I'm a monster investor. Ah, yeah, right. We all know how rich you are. No. 16 minutes past the hour.
There's a man who leads.
leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott is with us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. VAWatchdog.org, one of the finest of the veterans support groups out there. And big news in the veterans community this week, Larry, the Walter Reed Hospital. What's going on there?
Tom, good to be with you again. Last week we found out some very interesting news. Of course, earlier this year, the scandal at Walter Reed broke about the conditions at the hospital, veterans and the wounded troops being left to languish for months and sometimes over a year. No coordination between the military health care at Walter Reed and then moving them into the VA, the Veterans Administration health care system. This whole thing just didn't
pop up. Larry, I think most Americans don't even realize that there's a difference. It might be worth a minute of your time to explain that.
Okay, let's explain the difference. Military health care. Walter Reed is an Army hospital. Like Bethesda in Maryland is a Navy hospital. So you have Army hospitals, Navy hospitals. These are run by the Department of Defense, the military, sometimes just referred to as the Pentagon. When troops are injured or wounded, they go into a military facility. When they are considered healed enough to be discharged from the service and they go from active duty military status to veteran status, then their health care changes over to the VA system, the series of 1,400 hospitals and clinics around the country run by the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs. So there has to be a transition coming out of military health care into VA health care. And what we found out with the series of reports in the Washington Post was that system, which was named Seamless Transition, didn't work. People were languishing. They were spending weeks, months, and sometimes over a year waiting to move from one system to another. Last week, just some incredible news came out. And again, I want to thank Mark Benjamin of Salon.com for digging this out. That is, Mark Benjamin found that in 2004, August of 2004, Tom, the VA and the Department of Defense working together did focus groups at Walter Reed and pinpointed all of the problems that we found out about 2.5 years later.
Two and a half years ago, they, both the VA and the Department of Defense, identified the problems, and for 2.5 years, the Bush administration sat on this?
Pretty much so. What happened was there were a series of focus groups done. The focus groups pinpointed all of these problems, troops having to wheel themselves around Walter Reed from building to building, literally miles in a wheelchair trying to get reports. They didn't know who their counselor was. They didn't know what their benefits were. They didn't know the difference from the VA and DOD healthcare, like we just talked about. They had no idea what was going on. All of this was pinpointed in two focus groups, group reports, done in August of 2004. They generated a report that came out in November of 2004, and they had 12 items that had to be taken care of immediately. The two most important there was an outreach program for all Walter Reed patients. I sit down with every single one of them. Here's what DOD, the Department of Defense, does for you. Here's what the VA can do for you when you get out. Here's how we're going to help you go from place to place. That was never done. Also, education of the care providers of Walter Reed was a recommendation of this report. That was never done. What this report tells us is for 2.5 years, they've had all the tools at their fingertips and they had the knowledge. No action was taken to implement these programs and to help our wounded troops move from their military health care system into the VA health care system. And then we had to read about it on the front page of the Washington Post 2.5 years later.
Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org. This begs the question, why? Is this just so that there would be more money available for tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires? I mean, why?
That's a good way to look at it, Tom. It comes down to money. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the personnel to implement these programs. And I happened to dig out just a couple of days ago what the VA actually did. Instead of implementing these 12 steps in their own report, and some of these things are going to astound you, what the VA did. They bought blue lab coats for their personnel with a big VA on them.
That's what they did?
That's what they did.
That's
they bought, well, there's a couple more. They bought blue lab coats. Now, that way you could tell a VA person from a Walter Reed person, but the troops still didn't understand what those people did. They doubled, are you ready? They doubled their VA social work liaison officers from 1 to 2.
Wow, it's 100% increase, Larry. We should be really, really impressed.
A VA official told me they needed a couple of dozen people there working, VA workers there. They said they implemented a tracking system. There was no tracking system. It didn't work. The other one is put out a directive. They published a directive that obviously no one read, and they moved their staff from a smaller office into a bigger office. And again, a VA official commenting to me, asking to remain anonymous, said, creating this office, basically moving people from one place to another in the building, created the appearance of action. It served no purpose. What we see here, Tom, this whole thing was buried 2.5 years ago, and it comes down to what we've talked about so many times, and that is the funding issue. Military health care and veterans health care just haven't been properly funded by this administration. Troops get lost in the shuffle. People get hurt.
But billionaires get their tax cuts, Larry.
Well, I didn't get one. I just paid my taxes. You want to
see
them?
Larry Scott, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer over at VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And for the great work you're doing supporting our veterans. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Back with your calls. Four minutes past the hour. You know, sometimes it's useful to check out what the other side is saying.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yeah. The National Review. Mark Stein adding his voice to the John Derbyshire-led chorus. You can read all this over at thinkprogress.org. Blaming the victims of Virginia Tech. I am not kidding you. They're from Michelle Malkin, right across the board, the right-wingers are all blaming the victims. They're all suggesting that because these young men did not jump up and leap out and grab this guy's gun out of his hands, that somehow they deserve to die. This is what Mr. Stein says. He says, I'm not sure I'm ready to go the full derb, but I think he's closer to the reality of the situation than most. Point one, they're not children. The students of Virginia Tech were grown women, and if you'll forgive the expression, men. Forgive the expression? He says, we do our children a disservice to raise them to entrust all to officialdom's security blanket. Geraldo-like protection is a delusion. When something goes awry, whether on a September morning flight out of Logan or on peaceful college campus, the state won't be there to protect you. You'll be the fellow on the scene who has to make the decision. This awful corrosive passivity is far more pervasive, and unlike the psycho killer, is an existential threat to a functioning society. Sir, I would submit to you the existential threat to a functioning society is the idea that there shouldn't be a functioning society, but instead that we are all individuals, each one of us independent and totally lone, alone and responsible for ourselves. We are a society. We are collectively a society. We are a community of people. And to blame these young men and women who were murdered by this guy for being murdered is beyond despicable. It transcends disgusting. It reveals the true face of the conservative worldview, the true and tragic face of the conservative worldview. Phil in Long Island, New York. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Tom, great pleasure
yeah.
to speak to you.
Thank you.
You got it. You're right on. You're right on. You got it right on. However, I got a little different take on the Supreme Court issue. It's probably going to backfire on conservatives. And
I think you're right.
It will. It will definitely backfire on because these guys have always sat on the fence about abortion. For 30 years, they could have done something about it, but none of them ever did because it was too hot politically for them.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, they don't have that hot potato anymore. They're forced into a corner. We're going to see what happens, but I have a feeling you're going to, I like you, remember
backroom abortions, coat hanger killings. I remember that. It was horrible. And we're going to start seeing that again because doctors are just going to be too afraid. Malpractice is so expensive as it is now. You think it's...
Well, actually, we're actually already seeing that right now, Phil. There are entire states in the United States where abortion is not available, where it's simply not available. And you know, we are already seeing that. And it's not the kind of thing that typically gets reported. I mean, those, you know, it's the kind of thing that frankly gets more covered up. But I think your political analysis of it is spot on, and I do not disagree with it. I do think that this is going to backfire on them. And because the conservatives, they love to take these positions where they know they're going to lose. Oh, let's have prayer in the schools. Let's have, you know, let's outlaw abortion. It's lots of Sturm und Drang, lots of, you know, storm and you know, lightning and thunder, lots of opportunities for hyperbolic rhetoric when they know that it isn't going to happen. But when it actually does happen, then Americans go, they did what? By the way, I kid my friend Todd for being a stockholder. I think it's really cool, frankly, that he has done what I would encourage more Americans to do, which is rather than just, you know, buying into a mutual fund or something like that with your 401ks or your retirement plans, he's actually buying stock in these companies, which makes him a voting stockholder, gives him the ability to actually have his voice heard. And I think that's a great thing. So tip of the hat to you, Todd. 866-503-2270. And Eileen in Somerville, South Carolina. Hey, Eileen.
Oh, yes, hi. Just got a quote for you here. The pretext of religion to justify social control, I think that's what we're seeing here in South Carolina on the abortion issue.
We're seeing it nationally.
What's that?
We're seeing it nationally. This was a federal law.
Well, but we just passed a law here that even in the case of rape or incest, the mother or the young woman is going to be forced to look at a sonogram of the fetus. By doctors. Don't know who's going to pay for it, but this is
go ahead.
This is the state legislator's way of forcing even women who've been victimized into being turned against abortion as a possibility.
Incredible. Incredible. The forced abortion movement, the forced pregnancy movement is it's extraordinary sometimes their reach and hopefully what will be their overreach. Eileen, thank you for the heads up on that. That's terrible. Evan in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Evan.
Hey, I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay, good. Me too.
I have two things. One thing, the Second Amendment, it guarantees the right that states will decide what happens with guns. It says that Congress shall make no law that takes away it. Therefore, it pushes it to states' rights.
And it's for a well-regulated militia, and at the time, each state had its own militia.
The governor and the state to decide. It does not give the right to bear arms.
And the Supreme Court ruled that in 1939 in the Miller case.
And my other point is that in the face of all this just political and religious negativity, the manipulation of our judicial, our legislative, and executive branches on many levels, you know, in the face of all this, the greatest job of anybody who wants to see a change is a positive outlook, a positive embrace of community and our children and each other, and trying to really, really try to be the change and look at the world in a positive way in spite of everything that we might see looking at the facts. Not our opinions, but the facts, as Moynihan once said. And it would seem to me that that is the ultimate antidote. And every great leader that we've had, you know, throughout time has exuded confidence, not negativity, hope, not despair. And
but now we have, you know, Dick Cheney. It's
don't know the power of the dark side.
Do that, Tom, we re-endorse, we replay the movie in our head. We replay the loop of negativity. And we have to eat, you know, the food of our soil. We have to care about our communities. We have to take care of each other.
Evan, you know that I you know, you're singing.
I know, and is the antidote, though, is the opening up the door for the person and letting them go first before you. That's just taking the moment to care.
To conduct yourself well and conduct yourself appropriately. Yes, absolutely. No, well said, Evan. Thank you very much. Marcia in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Marcia.
Hi. Oh, please turn off the... Okay. I am not only talking about religious control. I am talking about permanent brainwashing. And that woman fainted in the audience is evidence of sophisticated brainwashing. It is
okay.
Heavily...
Now, Marcia, if I may interrupt you for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about because they might have just recently tuned in. And about an hour ago, I played a clip of George Bush speaking at the at Virginia Tech. And what he did in his talk was he revisited all the horrors of that situation. And
the students and faculty barricading themselves in classrooms and dormitories, confused, terrified.
And as a consequence of Bush doing that, which is something, I mean, at somebody's funeral, you would never recite how they, you know, all the gory details of how they died. You hold up a positive vision, not the negative one. But Bush did this, and as a consequence of that...
Brief interruption in the convocation here. You can see that someone collapsed on the floor, had to be helped to their feet.
People were like passing out. I mean, it was grim. So now that our listeners who may not have heard before, now they know what you're talking about. Marcia, continue, please.
Okay, and this technique has been used again and again. It was first used in England by Methodists to even get people to attend church to prevent people from organizing for better wages during the Industrial Revolution. It did cure alcoholism, and that was why it is allowed, even though it was extremely dangerous. But scarred neural pathways prevent people from making independent decisions, a la George Bush, who can't change path. I mean, this man is a robot. These people are robots.
Yeah, well, I would submit that he is a one-trick pony, and his one trick is fear. You know, it's all about fear and all the dark emotions, and that's where he always goes.
Okay, and the painting woman had cold beads of sweat on her brow and was shaking like the Quakers after hearing a hellfire and brimstone sermon. And these used to go on for hours and hours, and they got conversions because when people are really at their lowest point, they seize on any idea and they will keep it. All right,
yeah.
Oxford
yeah,
by
no,
Spin, huh?
Good point, Marcia, and well said. This is the most horrible, frankly, form of attempted political persuasion, shall we say, or as Marcia would call it, brainwashing, is to throw people into a state of fear. Fear is the most visceral emotion that we have, or certainly one of them, and to throw people into that and then represent yourself as a great leader. I'm sorry, I'm not buying it. 45 minutes past the hour. Well, in his 2007 State of the Union address, George W. Bush said, "In all we do, we must remember that the best health care decisions are made not by government and insurance companies, but by patients and their doctors. Unless, of course, they happen to be women. In which case, Mr. Scalia would like to talk with you." Marcus in Longview, Washington. Hey, Marcus.
Yeah, hi. I was just calling in with the idea I had on the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking that if we made it so after a woman had her first abortion, she, by law, she had to get her tubes tied, or she was at least offered.
Oh, you think women are like puppies or something?
Tubes tied for free, then maybe that would cut back on the number of abortions.
Marcus, do you honestly believe that there are any women out there who say, "Gee, I think I'll just, you know, screw around, and if I get pregnant, what the hell, I'll just go get an abortion. Oh, hey, let's happily skip down to the abortion clinic for another one." Do you honestly believe that there is even one woman in America like that?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm
then why would you suggest something like that?
Because there's a lot of reasons.
Name one.
Okay, the world's overpopulation. You got
okay.
I
think that we should offer tubal ligation and vasectomies to anybody who wants them for free. Sure, I think we should have a national health care program, and that should be included in it. But you know, after your first abortion, you get what, a sucker? No, I'm sorry, not going to go there, Mark. You know, I'm sure your intent was, you know, well meaning, but the story that is being sold by the forced pregnancy crowd is that women just go, oh boy, I think I'll go have an abortion. That sounds like fun. Nobody does that. There may be a very, very small subsection of people who are actually addicted to surgery. And maybe a few of them, you know, get serial abortions because they're addicted to surgery. I mean, there is actually a medical category of that. But those are people who are mentally ill, and there's a very small number of them, and doctors are trained to recognize them. That's it. That's it. Robert in Loveland, Colorado. Hey, Robert.
Hey.
What's up?
Am I on?
You are.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to talk to you. What I just wanted to bring up was that I seem to observe a form of sociopathic schizophrenia occurring on a societal level in our population. When you look at the difference between how this incident at Virginia Tech, which is obviously a tragic incident of huge proportions, is treated, and yet over in Iraq, how many soldiers die in complete obscurity on a daily level, that's something that I think the American population really needs to look at itself about, that just doesn't make any sense to treat things that way. And it's like a form of spaghetti logic that you observe in people all the time. I mean, just like your previous caller, the whole thing about, you know, that people should only be allowed one abortion and then, you know, somehow they get treated in a certain way or whatever type of deal.
That's adding insult to injury. Yeah, no, good point, Robert. And schizophrenic is the perfect word to describe it. It really and truly is a schizoid-like behavior. Mary in Los Angeles. Hey, Mary, and thanks for the call, Robert. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm going to just inject a little bit of levity into this very heavy conversation for just a moment and say,
please,
that as an avid, lifelong Star Wars fan, it very, very, very much upsets me when the liberals on talk radio constantly equate Dick Cheney with Darth Vader. The whole point of the entire story is that at the end of the story, Vader destroys the Empire and comes back to the good side. And so every time you play a clip of Vader and you equate it with Dick Cheney, you're insinuating that the man has some good in him, and he has shown us no evidence.
Did he really do that, Mary? I don't think I saw the final Star Wars movie, because I don't have any recollection of that.
That was Return of the Jedi, and he throws the Emperor down into the pit right before the Death Star is destroyed.
Amazing. Well, in that case, now. So
I love Darth Vader. I love him. He has been my favorite character since I was 5 years old. And every time I hear him and he's associated with Dick Cheney, it just hurts my heart.
Okay, well, here he is, and with your good words behind him now, not associated with anybody whose name we shall not mention.
Thank you.
Don't know the power of the dark side.
Now, what
I appreciate that very much.
Pardon?
I appreciate that very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much, Perry, for the call. That's, you know, you always get an interesting take on. There's always something. Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean, we've got about a half a minute here before we have to wrap up the show today.
Okay, I'm sorry, Tom. Hey, I wanted to call you and tell you that you know, I've been with you since day one, but.
I know you've been calling this program for,
Yeah, 4 years.
Yeah,
but I gotta disagree with you on the gun ban because, you know,
I didn't suggest a gun ban, Sean.
Well, no, not just event then, but I want people to guess whether or not, before they come into my household, whether or not there's a gun in here. If they know that there's not a gun in here, they're a lot more likely to come in.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. My personal take on gun laws is that it should be up to states and municipalities. That every area has, you know, different problems and different situations and whatnot. Although I am in favor of a federal ban on assault weapons and 50 caliber machine guns or 50 caliber rifles and machine guns and things. But anyhow, point taken. Thank you, Sean, and great to know that you're still listening. Tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Yaron Brook on his statement that the third world is facing challenges because they haven't embraced capitalism enough. And Danny Schechter is here about debtor nation. Don't ever forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.